Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
Tom, so you are now on stage here. You've got the Mormon audience, and just do whatever you would typically do to say, you know, again, bounce off charter all you want, but however you would present divinization, theosis, deification as well-grounded in Christianity, and then we can kind of start doing the dialogue with Mormonism at any point. You decide.
Sure, and I hope we can also get to some of the grammatical arguments, pro and con, because it's interesting what some of the opponents of this teaching have to admit grammatically, that terms like we are the offspring of God and how that goes back to the word genos and other things that we're a lot closer to our Heavenly Father than we ever thought we were. And I think, before I go into my opening statements, I'd like to say, I think we need to be careful with both extremes, that we don't try to make God so much other, okay, as the Christian traditions in the West primarily have done, where he's unreachable, where we cannot relate to him as B'nai Elohim, sons and daughters of God, and where we will never be able to do nothing but just, you know, contemplate him. Let us not err on the other side, where we make God totally human, and therefore he becomes an instrument of our imagination. And I really think middle ground here, where God can be personal, he can be locative, he can be real, he can reach us right where we are, and we can see Christ as our elder brother, and we understand that God has passions, and he has personality, and he has even human frailties that he shows in the biblical text. I really think, even with just the Bible, if properly understood with the early church fathers, if most of Christianity in the West understood these concepts, it would blow their minds. And part of the problem is we haven't paid any attention to the Church of the East or the Coptic Church or the Church of Syria or any of this. So when we hear these concepts come out of Mormonism, we often say, oh my word, you know, how blasphemous, because it didn't come out of, you know, evangelical modern Protestantism. When we go back in our history, way back to the Greek epics, the doctrine of kenosis was very well known, when the gods became men. So the discussion of man becoming God with origin, you know, and that's why God became men, so men could become God, you know, his famous statement, really predates Christianity in essence by quite a little bit. When we look at the Greek gods and goddesses, the suppers they ate, the wars they had, it's like in mythical Greek mythology, there was always this idea, well, how far are we from people? How far away from man is God, et cetera, et cetera. And the Bible, in both testaments, is really trying to say that we are the literal offspring of God. We are literal sons and daughters of God. So now let's look at some of the language that the Orthodox Church and the Eastern Church in general use to derive at this doctrine of deification.
Okay, great. Thank you.
The theological language is rooted in metaphor. Redemption literally means being ransomed or bought back. Salvation means, obviously, from the word sozo in Greek, to be made safe or whole. Theosis is becoming God. And, of course, in John chapter 1, the word genomai and, you know, other terms are read differently by the Orthodox Church than the evangelical churches use these terms about the Logos becoming man. And as we know, some of the Stoics said about the term Logos, it can also be understood as reason or divine speech. You know, so we're creating a construct if we try to talk about an eternal Logos. That could be true. It may not be true. Okay, it depends on how you interpret, you know, the Logos before Christ came to this sphere.
Okay. Let me just quickly interrupt here. I think most of our listeners would know what you're talking about here. Logos is the word, or the Logos is the word that in John says, in the beginning was the word. In Harche, hein ho Logos. In other words, in the beginning was Logos. And so you're saying that there's lots of meanings for what Logos could be. But I wanted to make sure that people understood that that's just where that comes from or where that comes.
Thank you. And I loved your Greek pronunciation there. I was listening to how you'd say the definite article there, and yeah, what the accusative means there to us is it's an expression of God that was expressed in Jesus, just as the nature of Jesus succoted or tabernacled with us. Okay, so,
nice.
So there's sort of a carrying on of that metaphor that God tented with us in Jesus. And that is ultimately fulfilled in the enthronement narratives at the end of the Feast of Tabernacles on the eighth day in the book of Psalms, you know, where God would come back fully enthroned, as Mulwinkle wrote about, and would tabernacle with men. See, and I think the prologue of John, which I think should be there, is trying to encapsulate that for us. And also the Logos that we are expected to be as sons and daughters of God to the children of God out there in the great multitudes. And so I think a lot of scholars are rethinking that, such as Robinson and others in the UK. Now, let's get some more words here, and then we'll get into some constructs.
Awesome.
Okay, the actual words of the fathers are used to express the doctrine of the thesis come from the Greek verb theo, meaning to make God, which is a term that was established in the Byzantine church after the 7th century as a result of its use by Gregory of Nazarenus, Dionysius the Areopagite, and Maximus the Confessor. Earlier, the broader vocabulary was used in the 2nd century. Irenaeus of Lyons spoke about the baptized becoming gods. Clement of Alexandria, a younger contemporary of Irenaeus, uses these verbs meaning to deify. And we can use other Greek words here, too, like apatheo and other terms in Alexandrian thought to actually show in the 4th century that St. Athanasius of Alexandria uses the term deification, the same Greek word there, meaning of all Christians. So in other words, you were like God if you were simply a believer. Remarkably, these terms are used in biblical authors as well as the ancient fathers who introduced them. Certainly, they did have pagan deifications, you know, as well in other cultures. By the time the 4th century was in full swing, a distinctive Christian vocabulary began to emerge. Terms like theosis, and of course with their correlative verbs, began to appear. In the meantime, Greek philosophers, namely Neoplatonists, were beginning to use these terms, but different definitions were applied to them. There was the Neoplatonic idea, the effect of divine power reaching upwards into the hierarchy from the source of divinity, the one of the intention who was drawing all beings upward with mind, unity, and of course with itself. Now, this particular doctrine in the 4th century had a great deal of influence, Neoplatonic thought, on the rest of the church, of course, even in the Eastern type of the Roman Empire. The place of theosis in the divine economy began to emerge from this, and the vocabulary of theosis was developed to express spiritual teaching, meaning our appropriation through Christ and humanity, how we were transformed by him in the passion and the resurrection, which, of course, today's Sunday celebration of the Palms would be right in the middle of that particular development. Now, there's a descriptive term for a transcendent aspect of self that was developed as Orthodoxy sees it today from this period. Now, let me take a quote here from Irenaeus. It says, "The Son of God became what we are in order to make us what he himself is." Irenaeus, Against Heresies, is where that quote would come from. Let's take a few others, then we'll go into a general understanding here of what the Greek Orthodox Church actually proclaims. "The Word of God became man so that you may learn form of man that is even possible for a man to even become God." Clement of Alexandria, Exhortation to the Greeks, and that's chapter 1, verses 8 through 4. Now, he became human that we would become divine. That's Athanasius. He gave us divinity. We gave him humanity. I think that's a very, very interesting one. That's from a hymn of faith from Ephraim. "Let us become as Christ, since Christ is what we are. Let us become gods for his sake, so that he became man for our sake." Gregory of Nazarenus, Oration 1, verse 5.
Now, you skip, so you did one more after where I thought maybe you're going to keep on the same one. In that one where, are you basically saying that God had to learn something from becoming human? Because that's pretty similar to something in the Book of Mormon that's pretty unusual, I think. Do you think that that's what that teacher meant? That God actually had to learn by being human?
Yes, yes. I think that's exactly what Gregory of Nazarenus is in Oration 1 through 5 is actually getting at. Wow. That God learns too.
Awesome. And so that would be prior to the I'm hearing an arc from you that maybe there was a Greek takeover of earlier teachings where they were much more comfortable with this sort of thing. And would Gregory be sort of a late guy who was still holding on to it before Neoplatonism completely took things over and with Augustine and all that stuff?
Yeah, that would definitely be my guess. And because they didn't have the fall of man is understood through Augustine's original sin, which the Eastern Orthodox Church still does not accept,
right,
that God can deal with creation on as deep a level because it's not flawed.
Awesome. That is so important to hear. Thank you. So keep going. I didn't mean to interrupt you there, but I wanted to kind of clarify that he was actually meaning true learning.
Yeah, exactly. The Son of God became the Son of Man that we might become sons of God. Okay, now that's even Augustine Mintz's sermons. He became like us, that he was a human being, that we might become like him. And I mean gods and sons. On the one hand, he accepts what belongs to us, and he's taking it unto himself as his own, and he gives us the exchange of what belongs to him. Cyril of Alexandria, commentary on John 12, 1. Isn't that interesting?
Love it.
So if we want to move, you know, onto some of the general theology, it would probably help us out here a little bit. Now, when we understand that part one of this, when we become a believer in Orthodox thinking, we become, on a new level, part of the image of God. And so we become an icon or an icon of God that begins to develop the characteristics of God as we are partakers of the divine nature, as Peter echoes.
Hey, Tom, the word icon here is so foreign to Mormonism that I would love you to kind of introduce it, because I know of it as an icon is a pointer towards something, and I often hear it talked about the importance of becoming an icon, not an idol, something being an icon and not an idol, something to see through rather than, you know, see through to something else rather than have something be the blocker of the view. Would you, you know, I just kind of want to have you reflect on when you say icon, what do you mean?
Well, icon in Orthodox theology, they image the worship to us in a physical demonstration of what the reality is behind it. And we see some of this in the Greek New Testament, you know, where the word icon or icon is used, that Christ is the image of God, you know, that behind Christ there is the reality of what Jesus brought to us. And that is the Orthodox understanding of the term icon, which can be translated, of course, image.
Right. But it is a point. It's always pointer. It's to be transparent, to show what's behind it, or to do it, never to block the view.
That's right. And therefore, our worship, when we do the old Hebrew masses and so forth, they are imaging what is in the ancient temple that mimics what God is doing in the celestial abode.
Awesome. Yeah, that's great, because that is language that's just not in Mormonism, so thank you for that help.
Yeah, yeah. And but see, we could get there together by understanding Mormonism's temple use of imagery. See, we would see some correspondences there.
Yes. Great.
Okay. As we look on, the person grows in God's glory, or doxa, as we know that John plays off of that a lot. You know, that we are children of God. We begin to take on the glory of God, and such participation brings us away from corruption, and it gives us divine attributes that is not affected or taken on automatically. In other words, we partner with God, is the Orthodox view of this. You know, we're not evangelical in the sense that, you know, it just happens like automatic toast in the toaster, you know. There's discipline, there's surrender, there's spiritual awakening that needs to take place as the soul is opened because of the fact at this stage of development, what we have here is the flesh are seen as garments of skin. And garments of skin in theological thinking of the Eastern Church is, do we do good works? What do we do for the poor, like the Egyptian third eye concept? You know, do we bring righteousness to the poor? In other words, our sarx, our flesh, our basar in the Old Testament Hebrew, you know, are we living as God intended us to live, and are we imaging him? So when we say, our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name, see, we take the Aramaic use of that. That means I must lift up God's reputation as I share God's glory with his creation. Okay, that's at the stage we're in. Wesley might have called it the second blessing, or sort of the state of the believer that has been sanctified, if we want to think a little bit like Wesley. We are literally God's offspring, says Cyril of Alexandria, quoting 1 Peter 1:4, and how our human nature has been exalted and transformed in Jesus. I think that's an interesting distinction there to note, that it's what Christ does as we ascend up the holy hill, up the mountain to Zion, as my dissertation has spoken so much about. We are the offspring of God, Acts 17:29 says, Cyril, we are partakers of the divine nature. We do not limit or we do not boast in the fact of what Christ wished to take us into an ultimate relationship with him, no matter what the truth, it's evident for all. The divine nature is God working together with the flesh. And I'm sure I can hear an amen out of that.
Preach it, brother.
All right. Yeah. Lead these sinners to salvation. Okay. For God and the Word together, you know, lead the spiritual development into completeness. And this is where our likeness really comes from, until ultimately we are united to the Father through him as a mediator. So Christ is to speak, you know, as a spokesman between humanity and divinity, since both are present within him. And of course, they're being developed in us as the prototokios moves closer to God's throne and to the kingdom of Zion.
Well, let's just pause for a second. What I'm really thrilled here is that we are hearing that just how robust, how openly this language that we Mormons, I think, a lot of time have thought that we're the only ones talking about it. It's because of the dominance of the evangelical, you know, this defines Christianity. I just appreciate the fact that you're just scratching the surface, and look at all the different ways that you're saying stuff really boldly here.
Well, isn't it interesting if we could go back to 1835 and bring all this information to Joseph Smith and sit down and have a discussion? Wouldn't it have been interesting to see how history might have unfolded a bit differently?
Mm. Would have undoubtedly had an influence, yeah.
And it's interesting, too, because as Dr. Witherspoon can also tell us that our knowledge of linguistics and the great Semitic gods and goddesses with the Elephantine papyri, where there's a Mrs. Yahweh, something that biblical scholars are having a hard time with. As we go back into our Hebrew constructs and study the mighty council and the conversations in Hebrew that go singular to plural, you know, we now know a lot more what's going on thanks to the work of Wesserman in Psalms 82, you know, verse 6, where B'nai Elohim is used along with the terms for judges, the retirement of the gods, and so forth, as, you know, those who oppose Yahweh, once their kingdom collapses, become the opposition, and then, of course, they become vanquished. And then when the mighty council, of course, gets involved, and some of these gods become retired, it's almost like Asherah, who's listed in the mighty council, is told to kind of sit down and not say very much. You know, keep your mouth shut there, you know, because we're having a royal family argument here. And a lot of this is very new, isn't it, in our modern scholarly debates about Yahweh and the mighty council. I mean, within the last 40 years.
Awesome. Yep.
And so, you see, if we go back and look at Joseph's time, he couldn't have possibly used some of the scriptures the way we now feel very free to use them. Because, see, when we'd look in Genesius, you know, lexicon and a lot of that stuff, we'd see, well, wait a minute here, Elohim, it can be used as the gods. Well, but then we have to understand there's divine conversation going on, you know, where it vacillates from singular to plural, and Yahweh's usually in the singular, the mighty council answers, you know, in the plural, you know, with the location of the Ugarit, Rosh Hashanah, and the KTU tablets, you know, we now can cross-fertilize that and see who is in the Semitic mighty council. That would not have been available in 1833 or 35. You see, so he obviously would have really been struggling with the use of Elohim, and yet how in the term Eloheinu, see, you know, the children of God answer back and say, you know, Elohim is our God, you know, or Yahweh is our God. And awesome. And so it's real interesting how you can even look at the triune nature of God. And the Eastern Church does not interpret the Trinity along lines of three persons, you know, one substance ontologically. They look at it as it's a completeness of God's nature, and it's influencing us to understand the completeness of God. So see, we kind of look at this whole evangelical, you know, argument over, you know, the doctrine of, you know, substance and ousia and, you know, the hypostatic nature of God in very, very different terms than the evangelicals battle Mormonism with.
Mm. So we could really use your help to say we could help explain ourselves better, you're saying, through this more fullness, completeness thing, rather than worry about substance and three and one and one and three.
Yeah, because, you know, the Western Church, you know, opted out after Chalcedon, you know, to try and come up with this, well, is he three and one or one and three, you know, over this hypostatic union. And to me, it's It's illogical. They are asking us to think, you know, with an illogical fallacy of concept.
Fascinating.
And so all these terms get turned upside down. They become theologized, mechanized, scrutinized, whatever adjective you want to put on there, rather than what they actually, meant to actually say. So when we get to the Areopagites and we get to, Mars Hill and Acts 17 and all that, I think that idea that we were the offspring of God, we're the children of God, and he's going to tell us which God he's talking about. He's going to tell us why this ton theon is so much more than the Greek mind had ever envisioned him to be. And he's just trying to open all that up. You know, it's like Paul Tillich said, there's really a God behind God, in a sense.
Yeah, I've got a question for you, Tom. You made several references in the scriptures, in the Bible, to humans being begotten, sons and daughters, or children of God. Could you elaborate a little bit on what you sense that that means? For example, even Paul's reference, of course, he was referring to one of their Greek poets who made that comment and basically making the point that, hey, I'm going to tell you who this God is that your poets have even said that you're the offspring of. What does offspring mean in terms of, from an LDS perspective, are we talking about spirit children of God, literally begotten? Are we talking about offspring in the flesh as the beginning of the human race? What exactly is being referred to?
Yes, if I could get my dissertation and quote all 12 languages and what I borrowed from LDS authors as well as from the Orthodox, one thing becomes clear. We have God's very DNA in us to say this in, modern terminology. And so I believe very clearly that's the side of this the New Testament comes down on. As far as the term genomoi and some of the passive middles that John uses and some of the aorist infinitives and other things, where something has happened in the past and it continues in human beings and it's done to us, okay, as God's begettal action. What I believe is God is making in human family his divine character and essence is what he is birthing in the human race. And as sons and daughters of God, we've got a heads up on that. What do you think?
So he's birthing in the human race. So as the human race continues currently, you're saying that this birthing process is going on as sort of this spiritual birth, or was there? So, is that what you're saying? Like the spiritual rebirth?
No, I'm saying that we are literally the offspring of deity,
as spirits in the spirit, or.
Well, the New Testament uses the term prototokeios, that, there's a bridal train that's being led to God. And it also uses the term protosomos, that we're kind of a mock-up of what we're going to be when God's image is fully brought to reality in the resurrection. So we're in process through the new birth of the Spirit in this life of participating in the resurrection of the fullness of that new birth via the resurrection, where we will fully have the doxia, the gloria of God's sons and daughters.
Okay. So those are applications, though, that go beyond, say, the LDS concept of in a distant pre-existent state, we were begotten spirit children of heavenly parents prior to being born into this life. Because what I hear you referring to is still this process that goes on now and will be culminated in the resurrection of God's divine nature, his glory, and so forth, being infused into us through the gospel plan, so to speak, if I'm hearing you right.
We do believe there was a divine infusion that is deeper than just spiritual character. As, you know, the Western Church fathers, I believe, errantly teach, that we have the very stuff of God in us, in the divine nature. However, I may not attach to it always a pre-existence of state where that actually happened, and I think, brother, you probably would.
Reflecting the LDS doctrinal teaching, that's the understanding of being begotten of heavenly parents. Typically, we associate that with a pre-existent or pre-mortal spirit birth, that we were born as spirits of heavenly parents.
Yes, but on the Orthodox side of that, they're just very open. You know, it's possible that, you know, could have happened, but we don't really see it in the New Testament corpus of literature expressed outright. So with continuing revelation from the LDS perspective, of course you'd feel the right to go there.
Yeah, and I think it comes back to this concept of we're using the same scriptures, but we understand them slightly differently.
Well, one thing's for sure, it doesn't come across as Protestantism does, though.
That's right. There's still an idea of theosis of some sort.
Well, and that man can become, you know, a son and daughter of God and be seen as the same classification as the Father is well within the Orthodox understanding.
Okay. I think an important contributor to the different interpretations is the historical context in which they grew up. I mean, this idea of spirit children being born of or created by heavenly parents comes directly out of polygamy doctrine in particular, and the idea that, you know, that was going to be the role of women throughout the eternities, was to house these spirit children. And it comes, you know, from an American scientific era, and, you know, you have Orson Pratt trying to use his mathematician skills to calculate how many heavenly mothers would be necessary to conceive X number of spirit children. And so I think that that's a really important part of understanding why the different traditions see the scriptures similarly, but still differently.
I think that's a very valid observation that you've made, and where the Greek Orthodox and Eastern tradition would have been battling Neoplatonism, we would have been trying to correspond it to the early Hebrew text, and then later on into the Eastern and West divide that took place in 1054, and, you know, all of the Christian history as well. Yes, I think that's very, very true. And I just think it's absolutely marvelous that we're having this discussion.
Me too.
Yeah, it's incredibly interesting. Yeah, and so, you know, what was on the minds of the early church, you know, as these kind of ideas of God were being further formed after Joseph's death, you know, was largely a protection of polygamy and a justification of polygamy, and sort of superimposing that model onto a heavenly, you know, kind of making God in their own image arguably, situation. And I think that it just, in both cases, it shows the really powerful impact that that the historical context has on given faith traditions' theological kind of development.
Well, for example, when you go back to the Magi or the Hakamim in Hebrew tradition, the Magi used a different form, even dealing with a Semitic trinity. They used early Semitic backgrounds that attribute visions of the Magi. In this connection of Graybar visions, he claimed that he had reflected in the 11th century a miniature form from Constantinople, and we can find this in the Greek library, where Trinity was kind of like Magi, carrying a person with them in the days of God the Father, Christ the Child, Emmanuel, representing, you know, the Holy Spirit. While there are problems with these interpretations, we really cannot separate our culture from the way we perceive God, I don't think.
Very interesting. Danielle, did you have anything more about historical context as being there? That was a fantastic point.
Yeah.
No, not really.
Okay. Well, when we get to the section where you're going to lead, I'm going to, you know, because I know that some of the stuff there's a layer of what you're saying about polygamy and how many wives, and this is going to be the role of women, you know, for spirit children and stuff like that. I know that that's been part of a reason for rejecting theosis, you know, in the cup, the sort of the couplet theology, people preferring not to have that. And I'm just thinking it'd be good for us to have a 5 minutes later on. Is that essential? I agree with you. That was the context in which it emerged, but is it essential? Do they have to stay tethered together? Do you see what I'm
right.
saying?
Yeah. Yeah. No. And I think that's really interesting. I also just would make a little sidebar note that the conversation that we've had so far has been really strongly gendered to the masculine. Mm-hmm. And I think that's worth noting, because in Mormon theology in particular, sex plays such a strong role and is largely understood in contemporary Mormonism to be and historically to be an eternal trait, and to have implications in godhood. And so I would be interested to hear from Tom, I guess, because he's referred to God as the Father, if that's born out of tradition or out of a similar understanding of God as having a specific gender.
Sure, I'll be glad to deal with that. Remember, in the Semitic tradition, God has names based on what God does. We tend to want to see everything in the Western church through a literal and theological lens. Mm-hmm. Now, when it comes to the Odes of Solomon, for example, the Ruach HaKodesh, the Holy Spirit, in Syriac tradition and Hebrew tradition, is often seen as feminine, as Mollenkott writes. And she's completely correct there. In the early apostolic church, the Trinity itself was seen as masculine and feminine, and to have attributes of both. So the Odes of Solomon make it very, very clear that God's nature, just like the Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, has masculine and feminine tendencies, so will we in salvation, when we will be the sons and daughters of God, as Paul said in 2 Corinthians chapter 7. So we will not totally lose the distinction of male and female and what makes us us. I can pull out St. Vladimir's theological dictionaries where we even believe many married people and the future glory will wear crowns and stephanos and different rewards that man and wife will share together in the future resurrection. We've written a lot about crowns being on the ancient heads of women and men when they were married in ancient Israel. We've written a lot about, that's why bishops wear crowns to this very day, is to show in the resurrection there will be an ultimate uniting of men and women. And so we have a very strong part and counterpart. Stefanik has written that on the thrones, when the final enthronement takes place, men and women will have love seats in God's kingdom that they will share together as they rule over the nations and bring healing to them.
That's really interesting. Thanks for going into that.
And thank you for your question. We'll go for it even harder when you lead out, Danielle. So thank you.
Sure.
On that sidebar. I love it.
Where a difference is would be the LDS understanding of exaltation. And we would see that as more salvation or salvific. We would see that as part of the just the natural growing closer to God. There's another difference. We hold more of a difference where it's God reaching into man's experience and bringing man Godward, as my professor Dr. Charles Dorothy from Claremont used to say. And so we're all moving Godward. It's because of what God is doing in his devonization of his new creation that will catapult us forward. So we don't have quite as much emphasis on the exaltation of man, although it is in the paradigm.
Okay. And so what is the imagined life of a resurrected, divinized soul? You know, versus, you know, Mormonism, again, like Danielle says, we're not necessarily the ones that are pushing this planet and all that kind of stuff. But what would be the perfected spirit, the kind of life that that being would have?
Well, Revelation 5 verse 10 says, we shall be kings and priests, and we shall reign on the earth. So we believe earth will be the headquarters of the universe that will bring healing to.
Wow.
Revelation chapter 11 and verse 15, the kingdoms of God come from the kingdoms of this world. And so, therefore, we don't believe in going to heaven, but heaven is the presence of God.
Okay, but you're doing stuff, and it sounds like you're doing redemptive work.
Yes, the redemptive work that we're doing after the millennium and in the new heavens and new earth, we are ruling with God as co-rulers on his throne. So there will be co-regent reigns that the sons and daughters do share with God's glory as the entire creation is reestablished.
Okay. So is there any sense of epics and, you know, perhaps this one will wind up and then God would start over and we would be part of a council?
Well, we have people who postulate those ideas,
okay.
but it isn't part of Orthodox theology per se. But of course, we do have those conversations.
Awesome. All right. So that's a distinct difference that I think will appeal to lots of Mormon sensibilities. Whereas, you know, we don't have quite that sense of the beatific vision being so overwhelmingly wonderful that we would just be perfectly happy to be, you know, a partaker of that. You at least kind of appeal to that whole, like, I want a job to do kind of sensibility that Mormonism has.
Exactly, because We believe that there's one reality, and we believe that there are levels of reality, you know, in the Hebraic sense. You know, there's Sheol, there's where the plant life is, there's where the earth has a navel and wicked spirits come from. And then, of course, you go up the chain, there's animal, you know, there's human, you know, then there's angels and, you know, cherubim and seraphim. As we go up the ladder, as my good friend Avraham Gileadi, you know, calls it, till we get to an exalted state. And of course that, you know, exalted state would certainly be the resurrection, where the rewards will be handed out and men and women will rule the cosmos together and bring the truth and salvation history to its proper conclusion. Then, of course, Eden will be restored, Zion will dwell on the planet, and heaven will really come to earth, and then the kingdom of heaven will expand throughout the universe.
Man, no wonder you're finding such an affinity with Mormonism. That is outstanding to me. I mean, I thought I knew some stuff about Eastern theology and the types of conversations you're having, but I clearly didn't. So this is just amazing. Okay, here's my question. I've seen it in some of the blog posts and things. As you can imagine, this couplet showing up in the manuals began a good conversation. And one of the phrases here, and so maybe this isn't in your immediate awareness, Tom, but they'll talk about, like, Stephen Robinson is an influential dialoguer with evangelical Christianity, and so he was making a point to say Mormons really aren't committed to the idea that we would ever be independent beings from God the Father. He says at most we would sort of be talking in terms of small g gods versus capital G gods. And so that's his statement. And yet I'm seeing lots of the comments and blog posts and things like saying, no, I think what Snow is saying with the couplet is capital G gods, creative beings that are basically doing the same thing that the capital G god that we worship now does. And so it sounds to me like you're presenting a position of here is no other being as divinized and doing these jobs and their regents and their part of God's team. There's no sense that they're ever capital G gods the way at least couplet theology is sometimes taken up. Is that a fair statement, Tom?
Well, it's true, but I'm actually stating something different. And Martin Tanner got very excited about this. When I read from the book, Fellow Workers with God, Orthodox Thinking on Theosis by Norman Russell. Now, I'm an open theist, so I'm not stuck in these static concepts where big G, small letter G, I don't even think in those contexts. I know that's something that we've inserted in biblical translations for proper names and, you know, lexical entries and so on. But I see it, and I think my Orthodox brothers will generally agree with me, that God is growing, that God is always going to be beyond where we are because he's God. But the good part of the scenario, that's a dynamic relationship that grows for all eternity.
Awesome.
Okay, so I don't really need to be concerned with who's a small god or a big god or anything. God has a family, and God is progressively moving forward. Although we don't have the Oliver Cowdery statement and the Adam God and, you know, those particular ideas put in there that God was once a man, as Brigham Young taught, but we do have a God who eternally grows and moves forward and learns, and therefore so will we as his sons and daughters.
I can see why Martin Tanner got excited when you said that. And are you minority position? Is this Russell person that you're quoting, is he a pretty big deal, or is this fringy stuff, or how solid in the or in the Orthodox tradition is this?
Well, in the Orthodox tradition, we just stop short of universal salvation. That's how open we actually are towards all things moving back to perfection as Yahweh, you know, originally intended. We stop at it in case there's a few nasty people who don't want to enter into the New Jerusalem, as the book of Revelation indicates. But we do believe that it's God's will that all would come unto salvation. And we believe in the resurrection that will indeed be possible, where ultimate healing can take place.
Man, it's exciting.
See, there's a lot we don't talk about in general Christian theology, isn't there?
Yeah.
We probably all get stereotyped and culture bound in our thinking, or religious bound.
I'm really pleased with this last hour. Thank you so much, Tom. I'm going to keep inviting you back, because there's still that fundamental difference of working with, you know, God creating versus working with uncreated matter. And I think we're going to end up. I want your critique in terms of the pragmatic value of that, of one teaching over the other. But again, there's going to be no sense that one is right and the other one's wrong. But I'm going to argue, at least I'm glad that Mormonism is keeping it in its discussion. So that's where I'm going to end up pushing towards the end. So if we're ready, I'd say let's move into a third section where we kind of now take a look at the status of the teaching within Mormonism.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive, or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.